At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
That's conversation between soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I just wanted to remind everyone about our Discord. It's really become a vibrant community. I'm on there a lot. Derek's on there occasionally. But most important, the conversations that are had there are pretty high level and pretty interesting. So if you are a subscriber, monthly or annual, doesn't matter, you can sign up for the Discord. So please visit our website, AmericanPrestigePod.com, to check that out. Also, don't forget, we have two series, Welcome to the Crusades, that's at WelcomeToTheCrusades.com, and Of This World, which is at OfThisWorldPod.com with our friend Danny Steinmetz-Jenkins. And just final thing I'd like to say, we really appreciate everyone who's been reviewing us on Apple. It actually has helped us. There's some stuff behind the scenes that probably shouldn't talk about yet, but I think those reviews actually really helped. So if you could take a moment, please just, you know, pause this wonderful episode in my beautiful voice and go review us on Apple Podcasts. We really would appreciate it. And I now have material evidence that has helped the show. All right, Derek, let's jump into the news. And let's start with this Armenia-Azerbaijan deal.
On Friday, I think we talked last week, Donald Trump was set to meet with Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and the President of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev. At the White House, they were going to conclude that with the signing of some sort of peace deal, which is exactly what they did. Mainly, the agreement consists of a pledge for a U.S. Managed, I guess, or U.S. developed transit corridor that will run through southern Armenia. This is one of the two big stumbling blocks, I guess, in terms of finally negotiating a full-on accord and normalization between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan has been demanding a corridor, rail, road, I think even electricity at this point, running through southern Armenia, connecting to Nakhchivan, which is an exclave. It's Azerbaijani territory, but it's completely separated from Azerbaijan proper on the other side of, it's on the western side of Armenia. So they've been demanding this. The Armenian government has resisted, fearing that this would, not without cause, that this would turn into a land grab, that they would lose territory. And so the solution apparently is to create this U.S. Developed transit corridor that would be managed. It's being called, I know, Danny, you want to know what it's being called. It's being called the Trump Route for International Peace and Prosperity, or TRIP. So exciting. This is going to be the details beyond the headlines. I haven't seen much, and obviously there's a lot of things that will have to be worked out in technical negotiations. But the idea is that the U.S. will get to develop this corridor, manage it, make money off of it. I'm sure Trump wouldn't have entered into this if there wasn't a pot of gold at the end of it. But it will be responsible for ensuring both that Azerbaijan feels it has the access to and from Nakhchivan that it wants, and that Armenia feels it still has control over its own territory, and especially its southern border with Iran, which is the big fear that this this transit corridor would have cut off, would have basically bisected the country. So it'll be the U.S. responsibility to kind of balance those things. There's, as I say, a lot to be worked out in terms of technical details. There are also other issues that need to be ironed out before Armenia and Azerbaijan will be ready to just say we're, finally doing a peace deal or finally doing a normalization agreement. Most prominently among these other issues is that the Azerbaijani government has been demanding that Armenia amend its constitution to remove any mention or claim over Nagorno-Karabakh, the region within Azerbaijan that used to be Armenian, ethnic Armenian territory before the Azerbaijanis ethnically cleansed it in their most recent conflict. So that could be a major stumbling block still, because the politics in Armenia are probably not terribly favorable. Pashinyan has called for a referendum on amending the constitution. It's far from clear that Armenian voters would actually go along with something like that. The idea seems to be fairly unpopular, but you know, we'd have to wait and see. There are concerns also about regional impacts. The two big regional players that are affected by this are Iran, which opposes the transit corridor in principle. It opposes, it doesn't have great relationship with Azerbaijan. It has a very good relationship with Armenia. So it opposes the transit corridor on that basis. And now with the U.S. managing it and probably having some sort of security presence there, let's not get ahead of ourselves, I guess, but that's a reasonable supposition. It becomes even less palatable for the Iranians to have this this thing very close to their border. Russia is the other country that potentially loses out here. The Russians have been the security guarantor in the Southern Caucasus since the fall of the Soviet Union. They haven't been doing a very good job of it, if you ask the Armenians, in recent years. But still, it is their backyard. It's their, you know, they feel it's their area of influence. And now for the U.S. to come in and put its stamp or its imprimatur on this conflict and to have a potential presence in the region is probably not great news or going to be particularly well thought of in Russia. Both countries have sort of tentatively expressed support for the agreement and for settling the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict in abstract terms, but they've both been a little wary about the U.S. Involvement in their public statements. Beyond that, you know, there are a number of other U.S. interests at play here. Trump is, of course, fixated on mineral wealth. He wants access to Azerbaijan's oil and natural gas. He's hoping to boost ties between Azerbaijan and Israel, which are already good. They already have diplomatic relations, but he's been talking about an expanded Abraham Accord style framework where there would be intensified economic cooperation, military cooperation between the two countries. That, of course, is another potential threat for the Iranians that they're not going to be happy about. And there's a sense in Washington that opening up the U.S.-Azerbaijan relationship in this way, you know, if the deal leads to that, is a gateway to opening up Central Asia and the mineral wealth there, which Trump is interested in. Also potentially doing Abraham Accord style deals between the Central Asian republics and Israel. So there's a lot of other stuff going on here that Trump is no doubt interested in. I'm sure he's happy to have his name slapped on the transit corridor as well. And to have two more countries, as both Pashinyan and Aliyev on Friday said they would, nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize, which seems to be a fixation of his. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that later.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Israel, and let's talk about that country's preparation for a Gaza City operation.
That's been moving forward. Benjamin Netanyahu took his plan for the next steps in Gaza, which includes an incursion into Gaza City and apparently at some time after that, an incursion into the central Gazan refugee camps. These are supposedly the final two strongholds for Hamas, according to Netanyahu, who said back in April of 2024 that Rafah was the final stronghold for Hamas. I guess it wasn't. Turned out it wasn't. The Security Cabinet approved the new plan late Thursday. The Israeli military, IDF, now says that its commander, Eyal Zamir has approved the general framework for the next, the IDF's next operations in Gaza, which includes presumably the invasion of Gaza City and this the subsequent move in central Gaza. I talked about a lot of this stuff with Mohammed Al-Safin in our special a couple of days ago. So if people are really interested in the in-depth discussion of what's happening, check that out. But there are a few things to talk about here, I guess. The IDF has intensified its bombardments of Gaza City over the last couple of days. So that suggests that they are ramping up to a ground incursion at some point. There's still no indication when that ground incursion might come. I saw one report that said it might not happen until October, which seems a bit far-fetched to me, but it's possible if Netanyahu wants to give some time to pound the city and maybe amid that try to intimidate Hamas into coming back and accepting his terms for a ceasefire. It is possible, I guess, he could delay the ground portion of this that long. The ground portion is the riskiest from the Israeli military's perspective. It's the thing that leaves their soldiers vulnerable to attack and puts them in a dangerous situation. So he may want to delay that as long as possible to see if there's a deal that can be made. Obviously, it would be a deal on his terms, not, you know, he's not at this point, I think, going to listen to any of Hamas's concerns about permanently ending the war and Israeli military withdrawal from Gaza. He wants disarmament. He wants, full victory, basically wants a surrender from Hamas or else. The Israelis are still, I should note, looking for countries to take in Palestinians. And part of the move into Gaza City may be intended to further the ethnic cleansing plan. One of the rationales behind giving people a couple of months, as much as a couple of months to evacuate, or is giving people that time to evacuate the city ahead of the ground incursion, which would push them south into, you know, designated humanitarian zones, so-called humanitarian zones. The goal would be to continue pushing them once you've displaced them from Gaza City, to continue pushing them presumably into Rafah, which is where the Israelis have talked about collecting virtually the entire population of Gaza at some point. And from there, they would be moved out to where nobody knows. There were reports this week that the Israelis were in negotiations with the government of South Sudan to take in Palestinians. The South Sudanese government vehemently denied that. There's another report that we'll get to actually in a little bit about a potential destination that we've talked about. But I still think you're looking at ethnic cleansing as the objective here, and it's going to be hard for Netanyahu at this point, given his own inclinations, given the political pressures that he's facing from within his coalition, to settle for anything less.
Let's talk about Australia, which has announced plans to recognize Palestine.
Right. There's a number of Anglosphere and just generally Western countries, as people know, that have announced their intention to recognize Palestinian state in September during the United Nations General Assembly session. Australia became the latest country to do that this week. There's a debate now happening in New Zealand, in the New Zealand Parliament, about whether or not to join Australia and join this group of emerging group of countries that will apparently, in some cases, they've qualified it. The UK has qualified its potential recognition, for example. But in most cases, this is they've just committed to recognizing Palestinian statehood in September. It's not a terribly meaningful act because none of the countries in this group that in Europe, in the Anglosphere that recognize Palestine will do anything beyond that to support standing up a Palestinian state, certainly not anything meaningful in terms of pressuring Israel. So it winds up being a demonstration piece rather than a substantive effort to help the Palestinians. There is symbolic significance here, but that's about it. I will note that the Norwegian government sovereign wealth fund did divest of a number of Israeli companies over the past, I guess it's been about a week now, primarily companies with ties to the IDF who could be, you know, kind of traced to the Gaza genocide. It has not done a general divestment from Israeli companies and says it won't do that. But that may be a little bit more meaningful than this kind of empty statehood recognition.
Let's talk about the IAEA representative that was in Iran.
Deputy Director Massimo Aparo from the International Atomic Energy Agency visited Iran on Monday. There was no real substantive component to this. They didn't inspect any sites or do anything like that that would be, considered under the umbrella of nuclear monitoring. But they did try to iron out a new framework for Iran and the IAEA to work together. Iran, as I think people know, suspended its relationship with the IAEA after the so-called 12-day war, arguing that the agency had sat by and done nothing while Israel and the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear sites, which is supposed to be something you don't do under international law. And then for the agency, you know, its response to that war was, okay, it's time to get back to, you know, inspections and monitoring. And I think the Iranians probably took offense at that. And so they suspended their ties with the agency. Now, if there's going to be any sort of resolution to the Iranian nuclear, I don't know what you want to call it, controversy, conflict at this point, since there's actually been military action about it. But if there's going to be a resolution to this that doesn't involve another war, or which, you know, probably is in the cards, but we'll see, it's going to have to involve the IAEA at some level, resuming inspections, resuming its monitoring in Iran. So these two parties are going to have to figure out how to work together. And Monday's meeting was sort of the first step to that, but it was very preliminary.
And what about European countries reimposing sanctions on Iran?
Right. The so-called E3, which is France, Germany, and the UK, sent a letter to United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres earlier this week expressing their intention to invoke what's known as the snapback mechanism contained in the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iranian nuclear deal. Basically, what that means is that any party to the deal can, any of the non-Iranian parties to the deal can go to the UN Security Council and say, Iran is violating the deal. We need to reimpose all of the UN sanctions that were lifted or suspended under the terms of the deal. It's set up so that really can't be blocked by any of the other parties to the deal. At the time, there was concern that, like, Russia has a good relationship with Iran, could use, you know, in a normal UN Security Council vote, it could use its veto to shield the Iranians from any consequences for violating the deal. So it was set up so that couldn't happen. What's about to happen now, with no new nuclear deal in place, and with the Iranians having, basically severed their relationship with the IAEA, and after Donald Trump, basically put the deal on ice in 2018, the Iranians have since, you know, violated it in a number of ways. With all of that in place, the deal itself is set to expire in October at its 10th anniversary, which would mean all the sanctions go away permanently, the UN sanctions, I should say, and a lot of the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program go away. And so the E3 want to reimpose all that stuff before we get to this October deadline, unless they offered, you know, the olive branch, I guess, that the Iranians could agree to a whole new nuclear deal in the next couple of weeks, because this is really, if they're going to do this, they have to do it by the end of August for it to take effect. So the Iranians could agree to a whole new nuclear deal by then, or they would be willing, I guess, to settle for Iran agreeing to extend the terms of the 2015 agreement for who knows what period of time. But certainly it looks like they're committed to this course of action if the Iranians don't do something. The Iranians have threatened, if the Europeans invoke snapback and those UN sanctions are restored, they have threatened to take some pretty major steps, like possibly withdrawing from the non-proliferation treaty. So this is definitely something to keep an eye on.
Let's talk about what's going on the Thai-Cambodian border.
Yeah, I mean, people, I'm sure, are familiar with the fact that these two countries went to war with one another for a few days last month over a series of incidents that took place along the border, along their disputed border. A number of them, at least a couple of them, involving landmines and Thai soldiers on patrol running into landmines. A couple more incidents like that have happened in the last few days. There was an incident on Saturday in which three Thai soldiers were wounded, at least one of them quite severely, when their patrol tripped a landmine along the Cambodian border. There was another incident that left one soldier wounded on Tuesday. The Thai government has accused Cambodia in both cases of planting mines along the border. Cambodia's argument here is that these are old mines. Cambodia is littered with unexploded ordnance, unexploded devices like mines from the various conflicts in that country during the 20th century. But the Thai government, every time one of these incidents takes place, insists that it took place in an area, first of all, that's on Thai soil, not Cambodian. Though, again, as I say, the border that border is disputed, but also that these are taking place in areas that the Thai military has already cleared inspected for mines and found it clear. So the implication being that the Cambodians have then come in after that and planted new mines. There were two of these incidents that took place in the lead up to last month's border conflict. So for two more to take place in such short order risks, I think, a resumption of that conflict. The Thai military issued a statement after Tuesday's incident invoking a right to self-defense that sounded pretty ominous. It hasn't developed any further than that since Tuesday, but the ceasefire that is currently in place and that they have sort of agreed to expand a bit with the inclusion of ceasefire monitors, that may be a real threat if there are any more of these incidents.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the Sudanese military leader who's met Trump's envoy.
Yes, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the leader of the Sudanese military and ostensibly what passes for, I guess, a head of state in Sudan, internationally recognized at least, reportedly met in Switzerland earlier this week with Massad Boulos, the Trump administration's Africa envoy, the State Department's Africa envoy. It's not exactly clear what they talked about. The broad contours were basically a new U.S. proposal for a ceasefire, as well as ways to get humanitarian aid into the country. Obviously, Sudan is in dire need of humanitarian aid, particularly in the Darfur region, where you've got people starving to death in Al-Fashir and other displaced persons camps. The Rapid Support Forces militant group controls most of that region, has committed a number of pretty heinous assaults on the non-Arab populations there. But as I say, it's not clear exactly what they talked about or what the ceasefire proposal might look like, what an influx of humanitarian aid might look like. The Trump administration obviously cut to the bone most of the U.S. foreign aid earlier this year, and a lot of those cuts landed on Sudan fairly heavily. So maybe they're rethinking that to some degree. I don't know. I think it's notable how little attention, as Trump has kind of been flitting around signing these, I would say, very superficial peace deals or peace accords, brokering them in different parts of the world in his bid to win himself a Nobel Peace Prize. I think it's notable how little attention his administration has paid to Sudan and that conflict. So maybe this is the start of a bigger push, but who knows?
Let's talk about the Somaliland president visiting the United States.
Yeah, this has some implications for Israel. Abdulrahman Mohamed Abdullahi, the president, if you will, of the unrecognized Somaliland government is reportedly coming to the U.S. This was reported in a number of outlets in recent days. I don't know exactly when he's supposed to be doing it, but he will be obviously pitching his case. He'll be meeting with people in the Trump administration to pitch his case for the U.S. to recognize Somaliland. Somaliland declared independence from Somalia in 1991. It is functionally independent. It's just not recognized by any world governments. But it's been pushing hard for that kind of recognition. People may recall that the Somaliland government did a port deal with Ethiopia, months ago that caused a diplomatic controversy with the Somali government, which didn't approve of that. But the idea was that Ethiopia would get territory or would be able to lease territory in Somaliland to build a port for itself, and in return, it would recognize Somaliland's independence. So they've been trying to get, you know, countries to take that step and recognize their independence for, pretty intensely for a while now. And Donald Trump has suggested that he could be open to recognizing Somaliland independence. And people around him have suggested they might be open to it. But they're looking for certain concessions from the Somaliland government. They're looking for some having to do with the U.S. It's a strategic position in the Red Sea that, you know, the U.S. might want to build a naval base or something like that. There are potentially, I think, mineral wealth to be had. But the main consideration that the Trump administration is looking for at this point is for Somaliland to agree to take in the Palestinians, any Palestinians who are expelled by Israel from Gaza. And facilitate the ethnic cleansing. So that seems to be the offer that's on the table. I don't know that the Somaliland administration is prepared to accept that. On the other hand, if they are desperate enough to get U.S. recognition of their independence, it is a potential deal that could be had. So again, something to keep an eye on.
All right, let's move on to these DRC M23 peace talks, which appear to have collapsed.
There were supposed to be a new round of peace talks that opened last Friday in Qatar. The Qatari government has been the main mediator in the negotiations between the Congolese government and M23. Of course, the U.S. mediated a deal of sorts between the DRC and Rwanda several weeks ago. But the Qataris have been taking the lead on the negotiations with this, rebel militant group M23, which is affiliated with Rwanda, that's been operating in the eastern DRC for some time now and had quite a bit of success. That round of talks was supposed to open on Friday. The idea was that they would be able to sign a peace agreement on August 18th. The talks never started. There hasn't been, as far as I know, there hasn't been like a formal announcement from the Qatari government that things have fallen apart. But neither M23 nor the Congolese government has any delegation in Qatar, so far as I know. So they, not only have they not opened talks, they're not really even planning to open talks, it seems like. There's been a lot of sniping back and forth between these two parties. The Congolese military has been accusing M23 of carrying out regular, I think they said near daily attacks on military positions in the eastern DRC. And of course, we're talking about North Kivu and South Kivu provinces where M23 is active. M23 has been accusing the Congolese government of dragging its feet on a number of kind of confidence building measures that were supposed to be undertaken according to basically a statement of principles or a statement of intent to which they had agreed, I believe, last month. Chief among those was supposed to be a prisoner release. The Congolese government was supposed to release a number of M23 personnel that it has been holding captive, and that didn't happen. And that seems to be the main thing that's sticking in M23's craw at this point. So it looks like, as I say, this is all broken down. That there's been no full recognition of that, but neither the Congolese government nor M23 seems to be in a particular mood to resume negotiations.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Trump agreeing to meet at a summit with Putin, as well as the fact that Ukraine and European leaders are concerned about that.
Trump announced on Friday, I mean, he had already said in principle that he was planning to hold a summit with Vladimir Putin. He announced on Friday that he would invite Putin to a military base in Alaska on August 15th. That's, of course, the day people will be listening to this. This was all ironed out in principle, at least when Steve Witkoff visited Russia last week and met with Putin. They discussed the idea of a summit. They discussed the idea of a three-way summit involving Volodymyr Zelensky, but apparently Putin is not interested in something like that. So Trump announced that he would hold this summit one-on-one with Putin on August 15th. And as you say, you could detect the freak out from Europe and from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky almost instantly. Concerns that Trump was going to cut a peace deal with Putin without Ukrainian involvement, that this would include the loss of Ukrainian territory to Russia, and that would all be done kind of taken out of the hands of Zelensky and the European governments. Trump held a virtual conference on Wednesday with Zelensky and several other European leaders to sort of preview his goals for the summit and to try to assuage their concerns. He promised that he would not be trying to negotiate a peace deal, that instead what he was going to push for was a ceasefire in Ukraine with no negotiations on any kind of territorial changes or anything like that. He's going to threaten Putin, he says, with what he called very serious consequences if he doesn't agree to a ceasefire. Trump said additionally he will be trying to set the table, that's his words, for a follow-on summit that would include Zelensky. And you know, who knows if he'll stick to any of this on Friday, but this is what he said in this session on Wednesday that seems to have kind of pacified the European leaders, pacified Zelensky. I still don't think they're terribly thrilled about the fact that this meeting is going forward, but they were at least mollified that Trump isn't ready to give away the store on Friday to get a peace deal done. Also, apparently, and this was reported in a number of outlets on Thursday, Trump apparently gave some sort of green light or promise that the U.S. would support a European tripwire force or European kind of security force that would be stationed in Ukraine under a potential peace deal that would provide the security guarantee or some security guarantee to the Ukrainians. The big stumbling, you know, the big concern over this has been A, whether European governments were really willing to supply soldiers for such a force, and B, whether they could do so without U.S. involvement, because Trump didn't seem, at least until this point, like he was particularly interested in participating. And the Europeans need U.S. Intelligence. They need U.S. Satellite support. They need a lot of logistical air cover, potentially air defenses. And, you know, they need a lot of logistical help, at the very least, from the United States to pull something like this off. Trump apparently gave some assurances that the U.S. would be involved in this. I don't know what he said. I just know that people who were on the call, who were, you know, European leaders who were on the call, came away sort of expressing how relieved they were that the U.S. would be involved in this operation. So that's pretty much where it stands. That could be a big deal. Putin has said, you know, he wants nothing to do with any European force in Ukraine. Like this, but you know, it's very difficult to imagine a settlement to this conflict, at least one that the Ukrainians could live with, that doesn't involve some kind of security guarantee, particularly under the supposition that some Ukrainian territory is going to have to go to Russia. You know, if eastern Ukraine, if the so-called Donbas region is turned over to Russia, that becomes a perch from which the Russian military could very easily launch a future invasion of Ukraine if there were, you know, if the Russians were to decide that they were unhappy with how things are going or just felt like Putin has a bad day, decides to take it out on the Ukrainians, it could be a pretty strategic location from which to relaunch a new invasion. So some kind of security guarantee, whether it's NATO membership, which Putin has rejected, or a European military force on the ground, something, it seems like a prerequisite for the Ukrainians in this deal. So it's potentially a big deal that Trump has seemingly acquiesced on this. Although, again, who knows what he actually said and who knows what he and Putin are going to really talk about on Friday.
Let's move over to Latin America. And why don't you give us a preview on the Bolivian election?
That's going to take place on Sunday. The Bolivian general election, including the first round of the country's presidential election. There will be a runoff in October if, as polling seems to indicate, no candidate achieves a majority in the first round. It looks like this will be a fairly momentous election in as much as the Bolivian left is likely, again, according to polling, to lose. This will be the first time that a right-wing candidate has won a Bolivian presidential election since Evo Morales won the 2005 election. It's been Morales winning, or Luis Arce, his former economy minister, winning every election, every presidential election since then. There was that brief period after the 2019 coup that ousted Morales, where the right, the Bolivian right, held power. But in terms of elections, they haven't had a lot of success. This time around, a combination of economic struggles and infighting on the left, Morales and Arce basically, you know, hate each other's rotten guts at this point. Neither one of them is going to be on the ballot. Arce is very unpopular. Morales has been demanding to be let on the ballot, but as this would be a fourth term, and he was really capped at constitutionally capped at two terms, that bid has been rejected several times by the Bolivian Supreme Court. So neither one of them is on the ballot, and the two leftist candidates who are on the ballot, Eduardo del Castillo is running sort of on behalf of the Movement for Socialism Party, which is Morales and Arce's party. He's polling in the low single digits. And Andronico Rodriguez, the president of the Bolivian Senate, who is running on a different ballot line, also a leftist Morales ally, although Morales is kind of broken with him as well in terms of, you know, in the run-up to this election. He's polling in the high single digits. The two candidates that look like they will be heading to the runoff are Samuel Doria Medina, a businessman, and former President Jorge Quiroga, both of them conservatives. So it seems like, and they have prohibitive polling leads at this point. Like, they're both in the 20s, I think, and the rest of the field is in single digits. So it doesn't, you know, if the polling is at all accurate, it looks like those two will be heading to a runoff. Morales, I should note, has been calling on his supporters to vote no, as a way to basically discredit the vote. If there are enough kind of, you know, spoiled ballots or null ballots, you could say the government is illegitimate, that type of thing. He's still very angry about being left off the ballot altogether. So, you know, it's that's another complication here, I think, for one of these two leftist candidates, is that you've got a lot of Morales supporters who might be favorable to Rodriguez, for example, who may vote for nobody, to sort of express their anger over Morales being denied a spot on the ballot.
Well, we'll let you know what happens there. Let's talk about Trump ordering military force to be used against drug cartels.
This was, I believe, last Friday, the New York Times reported that he had signed a directive authorizing the Pentagon to use military force against Latin American drug cartels. What could go wrong here? These are the cartels that the administration declared foreign terrorist organizations earlier this year. So this was in the cards when that designation was made. I don't think it comes as a great surprise that he's now taken this step. In terms of what it's going to look like, who knows? We could have drone strikes in Mexico or drone strikes in Venezuela or, you know, wherever these gangs operate. We could have, I mean, in theory, he could be, you know, this could be the green light to special forces incursions into Mexico. I mean, you know, at the maximum extent, you could have, you know, U.S. boots on the ground in Mexico to fight the cartels. Claudia Sheinbaum, the president of Mexico, has insisted that that's not going to happen. She wouldn't allow it to happen, first of all. And she also said after the reporting about this, this directive came out that she had received assurances from the U.S. government that this would not involve U.S. soldiers operating on Mexican soil. Nevertheless, I think, you know, if you want to talk about things to keep an eye on, this is a very slippery slope to some really dangerous stuff in Latin America and for the people there and the governments of the region.
And let's conclude on the United States and China extending their detente vis-a-vis tariffs.
They agreed earlier this week to extend the current tariff rates, which are 30% on Chinese products entering the U.S., 10% on U.S. products entering China, for another 90 days. They had agreed to an initial 90-day tariff reduction, of course, back in May after a couple of meetings. At that time, the rates were 145% tariff on Chinese products entering the U.S. and 125% tariff on U.S. products entering China. So basically, there was no commerce happening between the two countries. They agreed, as I say, back in May to a 90-day pause or reduction to those 30 and 10% levels, with the idea, I guess, that they were going to negotiate a more durable full trade agreement in 90 days, which seemed fanciful at the time and turned out, lo and behold, to not be the case. They were not able to iron out all the different disagreements in the U.S.-China relationship in 90 days. So now they've extended the current tariff agreement for at least another 90 days. It was to have expired on Tuesday. The first period was to expire on Tuesday. So now we can come back and do this all again 90 days from now, because I'm fairly confident. I don't know about you, Danny. I'm fairly confident that we're not going to fix the U.S.-China relationship in 90 days, even a second 90 days.
So not until we're invited in, at least.
Yeah, not until, right, and not until American prestige is given some access to China. I think we're going to be back here in 3 months doing the same thing, because it really would be economically disastrous for those the larger
two beautiful
to come
boys.
Back into effect. Yeah, it would really not be good for anybody. So I suspect we'll be doing another extension in 3 months.
Well, Derek, thank you, everyone. Thank you again for listening. Again, welcome to thecrusades.com, ofthisworldpod.com. Check out the Discord. We actually really think you'll like it. Everyone who pays for this podcast in any way gets access to it. And please review us on Apple. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc. See.